as the cause of tuberculosis. A few years later, Ehrlich found that certain toxins injected into animals could generate antitoxins, which bound and inactivated poisons with extraordinary specificity. These antitoxins would later be identified as antibodies. He purified a potent serum against diphtheria toxin from the blood of horses, then moved to the Institute for Sera Research and Serum Testing in Steglitz to prepare this serum in gallon buckets, and then to Frankfurt to set up his own laboratory. But the more widely Ehrlich explored the biological world, the more he spiraled back to his original idea. The biological universe was full of molecules picking out their partners like clever locks designed to fit a key, toxins clinging inseparably to antitoxins, dyes that highlighted only particular parts of cells, chemical stains that could nimbly pick out one class of germs from a mixture of microbes. If biology was an elaborate mix-and-match game of chemicals, Ehrlich reasoned, what if some chemical could discriminate bacterial cells from animal cells and kill the former without touching the host? Returning from a conference late one evening in the cramped compartment of a night train from Berlin to Frankfurt, Ehrlich animatedly described his idea to two fellow scientists. "It has occurred to me that it should be possible to find artificial substances which are really and specifically curative for certain diseases, not merely palliatives acting favorably on one or another symptom. Such curative substances, a priori, must directly destroy the microbes responsible for the disease, not by action from a distance, but only when the chemical compound is fixed by the parasites. The parasites can only be killed if the chemical compound has a particular relation, a specific affinity for them." By then, the other inhabitants of Ehrlich's train compartment had dozed off to sleep. But this rant in a train compartment was one of medicine's most important ideas in its distilled, primordial form. Chemotherapy, the use of specific chemicals to heal the diseased body, was conceptually born in the middle of the night. Ehrlich began looking for his curative substances in a familiar place, the treasure trove of dye industry chemicals that had proved so crucial to his earlier biological experiments. His laboratory was now physically situated near the booming dye factories of Frankfurt, the Frankfurter Anlenfarbenfabrik and the Leopold Casella Company, and he could easily procure dye chemicals and derivatives via a short walk across the valley. With thousands of compounds available to him, Ehrlich embarked on a series of experiments to test their biological effects in animals. He began with a hunt for antimicrobial chemicals, in part because he already knew that chemical dyes could specifically bind microbial cells. He infected mice and rabbits with Trypanosoma brucei, the parasite responsible for the dreaded sleeping sickness, then injected the animals with chemical derivatives to determine if any of them could halt the infection. After several hundred chemicals, Ehrlich and his collaborators had their first antibiotic hit, a brilliant ruby-colored dye derivative that Ehrlich called Trypan Red. It was a name, a disease juxtaposed with a dye color that captured nearly a century of medical history. Galvanized by his discovery, Ehrlich unleashed volleys of chemical experiments. A universe of biological chemistry opened up before him, molecules with peculiar properties, a cosmos governed by idiosyncratic rules. Some compounds switched from precursors into active drugs in the bloodstream. Others transformed backward, from active drugs to inactive molecules. Some were excreted in the urine, others condensed in the bile, or fell apart immediately in the blood. One molecule might survive for days in an animal, but its chemical cousin, a variant by just a few critical atoms, might vanish from the body in minutes. On April 19, 1910, at the densely packed Congress for Internal Medicine in Wiesbaden, Ehrlich announced that he had discovered yet another molecule with specific affinity, This one, a blockbuster. The new drug, cryptically called Compound 606, was active against a notorious microbe, Treponema pallidum, which caused syphilis. In Ehrlich's era, syphilis, the secret malady of 18th century Europe, was a sensational illness, a tabloid pestilence. Ehrlich knew that an anti-syphilitic drug could be an instant sensation, and he was prepared. Compound 606 had secretly been tested in patients in the hospital wards of St. Petersburg, then retested in patients with neurosyphilis at the Magdeburg Hospital, each time with remarkable success. A gigantic factory, funded by Hoechst Chemical Works, was already being built to manufacture it for commercial use. Ehrlich's successes with Trypin Red and Compound 606, which he named Salverson from the word salvation, proved that diseases were just pathological locks waiting to be picked by the right molecules. The line of potentially curable illnesses now stretched endlessly before him. Ehrlich called his drugs magic bullets, bullets for their capacity to kill, and magic for their specificity. It was a phrase with an ancient, alchemic ring that would sound insistently through the future of oncology. Ehrlich's magic bullets had one last target to fell: cancer. Syphilis and trypanosomiasis are microbial diseases. Ehrlich was slowly inching toward his ultimate goal, the malignant human cell. Between 1904 and 1908, he rigged several elaborate schemes to find an anti-cancer drug using his vast arsenal of chemicals. He tried amides, anilines, sulfur derivatives, arsenics, bromides, and alcohols to kill cancer cells. None of them worked. What was poison to cancer cells, he found, was inevitably poison to normal cells as well. Discouraged, he tried even more fantastical strategies. He thought of starving sarcoma cells of metabolites, or tricking them into death by using decoy molecules, a strategy that would presage Soubirous antifolite derivatives by nearly 50 years. But the search for the ultimate discriminating anti-cancer drug proved fruitless. His pharmacological bullets, far from magical, were either too indiscriminate or too weak. In 1908, soon after Ehrlich won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the principle of specific affinity, Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany invited him to a private audience in his palace. The Kaiser was seeking counsel, a noted hypochondriac afflicted by various real and imagined ailments. He wanted to know whether Ehrlich had an anti-cancer drug within reach. Ehrlich hedged. The cancer cell, he explained, was a fundamentally different target from a bacterial cell. Specific affinity relied, paradoxically, not on affinity, but on its opposite, on difference. Ehrlich's chemicals had successfully targeted bacteria because bacterial enzymes were so radically dissimilar to human enzymes. With cancer, it was the similarity of the cancer cell to the normal human cell that made it nearly impossible to target. Ehrlich went on in this vein, almost musing to himself. He was circling around something profound, an idea in its infancy. To target the abnormal cell, one would need to decipher the biology of the normal cell. He had returned, decades after his first encounter with aniline, to specificity again, to the barcodes of biology hidden inside every living cell. Ehrlich's thinking was lost on the Kaiser. Having little interest in this cheerless disquisition with no obvious end, he cut the audience short. In 1915, Ehrlich fell ill with tuberculosis, a disease that he had likely acquired from his days in Koch's laboratory. He went to recuperate in Bad Homburg, a spa town famous for its healing carbonic salt baths. From his room, overlooking the distant plains below, he watched bitterly as his country pitched itself into the First World War. The dye factories that had once supplied his therapeutic chemicals, Bayer and Hoechst among them, were converted to massive producers of chemicals that would be turned into precursors for war gases. One particularly toxic gas was a colorless, blistering liquid produced by reacting the solvent thioglycol, a dye intermediate, with boiling hydrochloric acid. The gas's smell was unmistakable, described alternatively as reminiscent of mustard, burnt garlic, or horseradishes ground on a fire. It became known as mustard gas. On the foggy night of July 12, 1917, 2 years after Ehrlich's death, a volley of artillery shells marked with small yellow crosses rained down on British troops stationed near the small Belgian town of Ypres. The liquid in the bombs quickly vaporized, a thick yellowish-green cloud veiling the sky, as a soldier recalled, then diffused through the cool night air. The men in their barracks and trenches, asleep for the night, awoke to a nauseatingly sharp smell that they would remember for decades to come. The acrid whiff of horseradishes spreading through the chalk fields. Within seconds, soldiers ran for cover, coughing and sneezing in the mud, the blind scrambling among the dead. Mustard gas diffused through leather and rubber and soaked through layers of cloth. It hung like a toxic mist over the battlefield for days until the dead smelled of mustard. On that night alone, mustard gas injured or killed 2,000 soldiers. In a single year, it left thousands dead in its wake. The acute short-term effects of nitrogen mustard, the respiratory complications, the burnt skin, the blisters, the blindness, were so amply monstrous that its long-term effects were overlooked. In 1919, a pair of American pathologists, Edward and Helen Crumbar, analyzed the effects of the Ypres bombing on the few men who had survived it. They found that the survivors had an unusual condition of the bone marrow. The normal blood-forming cells had dried up. The bone marrow, in a bizarre mimicry of the scorched and blasted battlefield, was markedly depleted. The men were anemic and needed transfusions of blood, often up to once a month. They were prone to infections. Their white cell counts often hovered persistently below normal. In a world less preoccupied with other horrors, this news might have caused a small sensation among cancer doctors. Although evidently poisonous, this chemical had, after all, targeted the bone marrow and wiped out only certain populations of cells, a chemical with specific affinity. But Europe was full of horror stories in 1919, and this seemed no more remarkable than any other. The Crumbars published their paper in a second-tier medical journal, and it was quickly forgotten in the amnesia of war. The wartime chemists went back to their labs to devise new chemicals for their battles, and the inheritors of Ehrlich's legacy went hunting elsewhere for his specific chemicals. They were looking for a magic bullet that would rid the body of cancer, not a toxic gas that would leave its victims half-dead, blind, blistered, and permanently anemic, that their bullet would eventually appear out of that very chemical weapon, seemed like a perversion of specific affinity, a ghoulish distortion of Ehrlich's dream. Poisoning the atmosphere. What if this mixture do not work at all? What if it be a poison? Romeo and Juliet. We shall so poison the atmosphere of the first act that no one of decency shall want to see the play through to the end. James Watson, speaking about chemotherapy, 1977. Every drug, the 16th century physician Paracelsus once opined, is a poison in disguise. Cancer chemotherapy, consumed by its fiery obsession to obliterate the cancer cell, found its roots in the obverse logic. Every poison might be a drug in disguise. On December 2, 1943, more than 25 years after the yellow-crossed bombs had descended on Ypres, a fleet of Luftwaffe planes flew by a group of American ships huddled in a harbor just outside Bari in southern Italy and released a volley of shells. The ships were instantly on fire. Unbeknown even to its own crew, one of the ships in the fleet, the John Harvey, was stockpiled with 70 tons of mustard gas, stowed away for possible use. As the Harvey blew up, so did its toxic payload. The Allies had, in effect, bombed themselves. The German raid was unexpected and a terrifying success. Fishermen and residents around the Bari Harbor began to complain of the whiff of burnt garlic and horseradishes in the breeze. Grimy, oil-soaked men, mostly young American sailors, were dragged out from the water, seizing with pain and terror, their eyes swollen shut. They were given tea and wrapped in blankets, which only trapped the gas closer to their bodies. Of the 617 men rescued, 83 died within the first week. The gas spread quickly over the Bari Harbor, leaving an arc of devastation. Nearly 1,000 men and women died of complications over the next months. The Bari incident, as the media called it, was a terrible political embarrassment for the Allies. The injured soldiers and sailors were swiftly relocated to the States, and medical examiners were secretly flown in to perform autopsies on the dead civilians. The autopsies revealed what the Krumpars had noted earlier. In the men and women who had initially survived the bombing but succumbed later to injuries, white blood cells had virtually vanished in their blood, and the bone marrow was scorched and depleted. The gas had specifically targeted bone marrow cells, a grotesque molecular parody of Ehrlich's healing chemicals. The Bari incident set off a frantic effort to investigate war gases and their effects on soldiers. An undercover unit called the Chemical Warfare Unit, housed within the wartime Office of Scientific Research and Development, was created to study war gases. Contracts for research on various toxic compounds were spread across research institutions around the nation. The contract for investigating nitrogen mustard was issued to two scientists, Lewis Goodman and Alfred Gilman, at Yale University. Goodman and Gilman weren't interested in the vesicant properties of mustard gas, its capacity to burn skin and membranes. They were captivated by the Krumpar effect, the gas's capacity to decimate white blood cells. Could this effect, or some etiolated cousin of it, be harnessed in a controlled setting, in a hospital, in tiny monitored doses, to target malignant white cells? To test this concept, Gilman and Goodman began with animal studies. Injected intravenously into rabbits and mice, the mustards made the normal white cells of the blood and bone marrow almost disappear, without producing all the nasty vesicant actions, dissociating the two pharmacological effects. Encouraged, Gilman and Goodman moved on to human studies, focusing on lymphomas, cancers of the lymph glands. In 1942, they persuaded a thoracic surgeon, Gustav Lindskog, to treat a 48-year-old New York silversmith with lymphoma with 10 continuous doses of intravenous mustard. It was a one-off experiment, but it worked. In men, as in mice, the drug produced miraculous remissions. The swollen glands disappeared. Clinicians described the phenomenon as an eerie softening of the cancer, as if the hard carapace of cancer that Galen had so vividly described nearly 2,000 years ago had melted away. But the responses were followed, inevitably, by relapses. The softened tumors would harden again and recur, just as Farber's leukemias had vanished, then reappeared violently. Bound by secrecy during the war years, Goodman and Gilman eventually published their findings in 1946, several months before Farber's paper on antifolates appeared in the press. Just a few hundred miles south of Yale, at the Burroughs Wellcome Laboratory in New York, the biochemist George Hitchings had also turned to Ehrlich's method to find molecules with a specific ability to kill cancer cells. Inspired by Yella Subbarao's antifolates, Hitchings focused on synthesizing decoy molecules that when taken up by cells, killed them. His first targets were precursors of DNA and RNA. Hitching's approach was broadly disdained by academic scientists as a fishing expedition. Scientists in academia stood disdainfully apart from this kind of activity, a colleague of Hitching's recalled. They argued that it would be premature to attempt chemotherapy without sufficient basic knowledge about biochemistry, physiology, and pharmacology. In truth, the field had been sterile for 35 years or so since Ehrlich's work. By 1944, Hitching's fishing expedition had yet to yield a single chemical fish. Mounds of bacterial plates had grown around him like a molding, decrepit garden with still no sign of a promised drug. Almost on instinct, he hired a young assistant named Gertrude Elian, whose future seemed even more precarious than Hitching's. The daughter of Lithuanian immigrants, born with a precocious scientific intellect and a thirst for chemical knowledge, Elian had completed a master's degree in chemistry from New York University in 1941 while teaching high school science during the day and performing her research for her thesis at night and on weekends. Although highly qualified, talented, and driven, she had been unable to find a job in an academic laboratory. Frustrated by repeated rejections, she had found a position as a supermarket product supervisor. When Hitching's found Trudy Elian, who would soon become one of the most innovative synthetic chemists of her generation and a future Nobel laureate, she was working for a food lab in New York, testing the acidity of pickles and the color of egg yolk going into mayonnaise. Rescued from a life of pickles and mayonnaise, Gertrude Elian leapt into synthetic chemistry. Like Hitching's, she started off by hunting for chemicals that could block bacterial growth by inhibiting DNA, but then added her own strategic twist. Instead of sifting through mounds of unknown chemicals at random, Elian focused on one class of compounds, called purines. Purines were ring-like molecules with a central core of 6 carbon atoms that were known to be involved in the building of DNA. She thought she would add various chemical side chains to each of the 6 carbon atoms, producing dozens of new variants of purine. Elian's collection of new molecules was a strange merry-go-round of beasts. One molecule, 2,6-diaminopurine, was too toxic at even low doses to give the drug to animals. Another molecule smelled like garlic purified 1,000 times. Many were unstable or useless, or both. But in 1951, Elian found a variant molecule called 6-mercaptopurine, or 6-MP. 6-MP failed some preliminary toxicological tests on animals. The drug is strangely toxic to dogs, and was nearly abandoned. But the success of mustard gas in killing cancer cells had boosted the confidence of early chemotherapists. In 1948, Cornelius Dusty Rhodes, a former Army officer, left his position as chief of the Army's Chemical Warfare Unit to become the director of the Memorial Hospital and its attached research institute, thus sealing the connection between the chemical warfare of the battlefields and the chemical warfare in the body. Intrigued by the cancer-killing properties of poisonous chemicals, Rhodes actively pursued a collaboration between Hitching's and Elian's lab at Burroughs Wellcome and Memorial Hospital. Within months of having been tested on cells in a petri dish, 6-MP was packaged off to be tested in human patients. Predictably, the first target was acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the rare tumor that now occupied the limelight of oncology. In the early 1950s, two physician scientists, Joseph Birchenall and Mary Lois Murphy, launched a clinical trial at Memorial to use 6-MP on children with ALL. Birchenall and Murphy were astonished by the speedy remissions produced by 6-MP. Leukemia cells flickered and vanished in the bone marrow and the blood, often within a few days of treatment. But, like the remissions in Boston, these were disappointingly temporary, lasting only a few weeks. As with Farber's antifolates, there was only a fleeting glimpse of a cure. The goodness of show business. The name Jimmy is a household word in New England, a nickname for the boy next door. The house that Jimmy built. I've made a long voyage and been to a strange country, and I've seen the dark man very close. Thomas Wolfe. Flickering and feeble, the leukemia remissions in Boston and New York nevertheless mesmerized Farber. If lymphoblastic leukemia, one of the most lethal forms of cancer, could be thwarted by two distinct chemicals, even if only for a month or two, then perhaps a deeper principle was at stake. Perhaps a series of such poisons was hidden in the chemical world, perfectly designed to obliterate cancer cells, but spare normal cells. The fingerling of that idea kept knocking in his mind as he paced up and down the wards every evening, writing notes and examining smears late into the night. Perhaps he had stumbled upon an even more provocative principle, that cancer could be cured by chemicals alone. But how might he jumpstart the discovery of these incredible chemicals? His operation in Boston was clearly far too small. How might he create a more powerful platform to propel him toward the cure for childhood leukemia, and then for cancer at large? Scientists often study the past as obsessively as historians, because few other professions depend so acutely on it. Every experiment is a conversation with a prior experiment. Every new theory, a refutation of the old. Farber, too, studied the past compulsively. And the episode that pivotally fascinated him was the story of the National Polio Campaign. As a student at Harvard in the 1920s, Farber had witnessed polio epidemics sweeping through the city, leaving waves of paralyzed children in their wake. In the acute phase of polio, the virus can paralyze the diaphragm, making it nearly impossible to breathe. Even a decade later, in the mid-1930s, the only treatment available for this paralysis was an artificial respirator known as the iron lung. As Farber had rounded on the wards of Children's Hospital as a resident, iron lungs had continuously huffed in the background, with children suspended within these dreaded contraptions often for weeks on end. The suspension of patients inside these iron lungs symbolized the limbo-like, paralytic state of polio research. Little was known about the nature of the virus or the biology of the infection, and campaigns to control the spread of polio were poorly advertised and generally ignored by the public. Polio research was shaken out of its torpor by Franklin Roosevelt in 1937. A victim of a prior epidemic, paralyzed from the waist down, Roosevelt had launched a polio hospital and research center called the Warm Springs Foundation in Georgia in 1927. At first, his political advisors tried to distance his image from the disease. A paralyzed president trying to march a nation out of a depression was considered a disastrous image. Roosevelt's public appearances were thus elaborately orchestrated to show him only from the waist up. But re-elected by a staggering margin in 1936, a defiant and resurgent Roosevelt returned to his original cause and launched the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, an advocacy group to advance research on and publicize polio. The foundation, the largest disease-focused association in American history, galvanized polio research. Within 1 year of its launch, the actor Eddie Cantor created the March of Dimes campaign for the foundation, a massive and highly coordinated national fundraising effort that asked every citizen to send Roosevelt a dime to support polio education and research. Hollywood celebrities, Broadway stars, and radio personalities soon joined the bandwagon, and the response was dazzling. Within a few weeks, 2,680,000 dimes had poured into the White House. Posters were widely circulated, and money and public attention flooded into polio research. By the late 1940s, funded in part by these campaigns, John Enders had nearly succeeded in culturing poliovirus in his lab, and Sabin and Salk, building on Enders' work, were well on their way to preparing the first polio vaccines. Farber fantasized about a similar campaign for leukemia, perhaps for cancer in general. He envisioned a foundation for children's cancer that would spearhead the effort. But he needed an ally to help launch the foundation, preferably an ally outside the hospital, where he had few allies. Farber did not need to look far. In early May 1947, while Farber was still in the middle of his eminopterin trial, a group of men from the Variety Club of New England, led by Bill Koster, toured his laboratory. Founded in 1927 in Philadelphia by a group of men in show business, producers, directors, actors, entertainers, and film theater owners, the Variety Club had initially been modeled after the dining clubs of New York and London. But in 1928, just a year after its inception, the club had unwittingly acquired a more active social agenda. In the winter of 1928, with the city teetering on the abyss of the Depression, a woman had abandoned her child at the doorstep of the Sheridan Square Film Theater. A note pinned on the child read, "Please take care of my baby. Her name is Catherine. I can no longer take care of her. I have 8 others. My husband is out of work. She was born on Thanksgiving Day. I have always heard of the goodness of show business, and I pray to God that you will look out for her." The cinematic melodrama of the episode and the heartfelt appeal to the goodness of show business made a deep impression on the members of the fledgling club. Adopting the orphan girl, the club paid for her upbringing and education. She was given the name Catherine Variety Sheridan, her middle name for the club and her last name for the theater outside which she had been found. The Catherine Sheridan story was widely reported in the press and brought more media exposure to the club than its members had ever envisioned. Thrust into the public eye as a philanthropic organization, the club now made children's welfare its project. In the late 1940s, as the boom in post-war movie making brought even more money into the club's coffers, new chapters of the club sprouted in cities throughout the nation. Catherine Sheridan's story and her photograph were printed and publicized in club offices throughout the nation. Sheridan became the club's unofficial mascot. The influx of money and public attention also brought a search for other children's charity projects. Koster's visit to the Children's Hospital in Boston was a scouting mission to find another such project. He was escorted around the hospital to the labs and clinics of prominent doctors. When Koster asked the chief of hematology at Children's for suggestions for donations to the hospital, the chief was characteristically cautious. "Well, I need a new microscope," he said. In contrast, when Koster stopped by Farber's office, he found an excitable, articulate scientist with a larger-than-life vision, a messiah in a box. Farber didn't want a microscope. He had an audacious, telescopic plan that captivated Koster. Farber asked the club to help him create a new fund to build a massive research hospital dedicated to children's cancer. Farber and Koster got started immediately. In early 1948, they launched an organization called the Children's Cancer Research Fund to jumpstart research and advocacy around children's cancers. In March 1948, they organized a raffle to raise money and netted $45,456, an impressive amount to start, but still short of what Farber and Koster hoped for. Cancer research, they felt, needed a more effective message, a strategy to catapult it into public fame. Sometime that spring, Koster, remembering the success with Sheridan, had the inspired idea of finding a mascot for Farber's research fund, a Catherine Sheridan for cancer. Koster and Farber searched children's wards and Farber's clinic for a poster child to pitch the fund to the public. It was not a promising quest. Farber was treating several children with aminopterin, and the beds in the wards upstairs were filled with miserable patients, dehydrated and nauseated from chemotherapy, children barely able to hold their heads and bodies upright, let alone be paraded publicly as optimistic mascots for cancer treatment. Looking frantically through the patient lists, Farber and Koster found a single child healthy enough to carry the message. A lanky, cherubic, blue-eyed blonde child named Einar Gustafsson, who did not have leukemia, but was being treated for a rare kind of lymphoma in his intestines. Gustafsson was quiet and serious, a precociously self-assured boy from New Sweden, Maine. His grandparents were Swedish immigrants, and he lived on a potato farm and attended a single-room schoolhouse. In the late summer of 1947, just after blueberry season, he had complained of a gnawing, wrenching pain in his stomach. Doctors in Lewiston, suspecting appendicitis, had operated on his appendix, but found the lymphoma instead. Survival rates for the disease were low at 10%. Thinking that chemotherapy had a slight chance to save him, his doctor sent Gustafsson to Farber's care in Boston. Einar Gustafsson, though, was a mouthful of a name. Farber and Koster, in a flash of inspiration, rechristened him Jimmy. Koster now moved quickly to market Jimmy. On May 22, 1948, on a warm Saturday night in the Northeast, Ralph Edwards, the host of the radio show Truth or Consequences, interrupted his usual broadcast from California and linked to a radio station in Boston. "Part of the function of Truth or Consequences," Edwards began, "is to bring this old parlor game to people who are unable to come to the show. Tonight, we take you to a little fellow named Jimmy. We are not going to give you his last name because he's just like thousands of other young fellows and girls in private homes and hospitals all over the country. Jimmy is suffering from cancer. He's a swell little guy, and although he cannot figure out why he isn't out with the other kids, he does love his baseball and follows every move of his favorite team, the Boston Braves. Now, by the magic of radio, we're going to span the breadth of the United States and take you right up to the bedside of Jimmy, in one of America's great cities, Boston, Massachusetts, and into one of America's great hospitals, the Children's Hospital in Boston, whose staff is doing such an outstanding job of cancer research. Up to now, Jimmy has not heard us. Give us Jimmy, please." Then, over a crackle of static, Jimmy could be heard. "Jimmy." "Hi." Edwards. "Hi, Jimmy. This is Ralph Edwards of the Truth or Consequences radio program. I've heard you like baseball. Is that right?" Jimmy. "Yeah, it's my favorite sport." Edwards. "It's your favorite sport? Who do you think is going to win the pennant this year?" Jimmy. "The Boston Braves, I hope." After more banter, Edwards sprang the parlor trick that he had promised. Edwards. "Have you ever met Phil Macy?" Jimmy. "No." Phil Macy, walking in. "Hi, Jimmy. My name is Phil Macy." Edwards. "What? Who's that, Jimmy?" Jimmy, gasping. "Phil Macy." Edwards. "And where is he?" Jimmy. "In my room." Edwards. "Well, what do you know? Right here in your hospital room, Phil Macy from Berlin, Illinois. Who's the best home run hitter on the team, Jimmy?" Jimmy. "Jeff Heath." Heath entered the room. Edwards. "Who's that, Jimmy?" Jimmy. "Jeff Heath." As Jimmy gasped, player after player filed into his room bearing T-shirts, signed baseballs, game tickets, and caps. Eddie Stanky, Bob Elliott, Earl Torgerson, Johnny Sane, Alvin Dark, Jim Russell, Tommy Holmes. A piano was wheeled in. The Braves struck up the song, accompanied by Jimmy, who sang loudly and enthusiastically off-key. "Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back." The crowd in Edwards' studio cheered, some noting the poignancy of the last line, many nearly moved to tears. At the end of the broadcast, the remote link from Boston was disconnected. Edwards paused and lowered his voice. "Now listen, folks. Jimmy can't hear this, can he? We're not using any photographs of him or using his full name, or he will know about this. Let's make Jimmy and thousands of boys and girls who are suffering from cancer happy by aiding the research to help find a cure for cancer in children. Because by researching children's cancer, we automatically help the adults and stop it at the outset. Now, we know that one thing little Jimmy wants most is a television set to watch the baseball games as well as hear them. If you and your friends send in your quarters, dollars, and tens of dollars tonight to Jimmy for the Children's Cancer Research Fund, and over $200,000 is contributed to this worthy cause, we'll see to it that Jimmy gets his television set." The Edwards broadcast lasted 8 minutes. Jimmy spoke 12 sentences and sang one song. The word "swell" was used 5 times. Little was said of Jimmy's cancer. It lurked unmentionably in the background, the ghost in the hospital room. The public response was staggering. Even before the Braves had left Jimmy's room that evening, donors had begun to line up outside the lobby of the Children's Hospital. Jimmy's mailbox was inundated with postcards and letters, some of them addressed simply to Jimmy, Boston, Massachusetts. Some sent dollar bills with their letters or wrote checks. Children mailed in pocket money in quarters and dimes. The Braves pitched in with their own contributions. By May 1948, the $20,000 mark set by Koster had long been surpassed. More than $231,000 had rolled in. Hundreds of red and white tin cans for donations for the Jimmy Fund were posted outside baseball games. Cans were passed around in film theaters to collect dimes and quarters. Little League players in baseball uniforms went door to door with collection cans on sweltering summer nights. Jimmy Days were held in the small towns throughout New England. Jimmy's Promise Television, a black-and-white set with a 12-inch screen set into a wooden box, arrived and was set up on a white bench between hospital beds. In the fast-growing, fast-consuming world of medical research in 1948, the $231,000 raised by the Jimmy Fund was an impressive but still modest sum, enough to build a few floors of a new building in Boston, but far from enough to build a national scientific edifice against cancer. In comparison, in 1944, the Manhattan Project spent $100 million every month at the Oak Ridge site. In 1948, Americans spent more than $126 million on Coca-Cola alone. But to measure the genius of the Jimmy campaign in dollars and cents is to miss its point. For Farber, the Jimmy Fund campaign was an early experiment, the building of another model. The campaign against cancer, Farber learned, was much like a political campaign. It needed icons, mascots, images, slogans, the strategies of advertising as much as the tools of science. For any illness to rise to political prominence, it needed to be marketed, just as a political campaign needed marketing. A disease needed to be transformed politically before it could be transformed scientifically. If Farber's antifolates were his first discovery in oncology, then this critical truth was his second. It set off a seismic transformation in his career that would far outstrip his transformation from a pathologist to a leukemia doctor. This second transformation, from a clinician into an advocate for cancer research, reflected the transformation of cancer itself. The emergence of cancer from its basement into the glaring light of publicity would change the trajectory of this story. It is a metamorphosis that lies at the heart of this book. The House That Jimmy Built. Etymologically, patient means sufferer. It is not suffering as such that is most deeply feared, but suffering that degrades. Susan Sontag, Illness as Metaphor. Sidney Farber's entire purpose consists only of hopeless cases. Medical World News, November 25, 1966. There was a time when Sidney Farber had joked about the smallness of his laboratory. One assistant and 10,000 mice, he had called it. In fact, his entire medical life could have been measured in single digits. One room, the size of a chemist's closet, stuffed into the basement of a hospital. One drug, aminopterin, which sometimes briefly extended the life of a child with leukemia. One remission in five, the longest lasting no longer than 1 year. By the early months of 1951, however, Farber's work was growing exponentially, moving far beyond the reaches of his old laboratory. His outpatient clinic, thronged by parents and their children, had to be moved outside the hospital to larger quarters in a residential apartment building on the corner of Binney Street and Longwood Avenue. But even the new clinic was soon overloaded. The inpatient wards at Children's had also filled up quickly. Since Farber was considered an intruder by many of the pediatricians at Children's, increasing ward space within the hospital was out of the question. Most of the doctors thought him conceited and inflexible, a hospital volunteer recalled. At Children's, even if there was space for a few of his bodies, there was no more space for his ego. Isolated and angry, Farber now threw himself into fundraising. He needed an entire building to house all his patients. Frustrated in his efforts to galvanize the medical school into building a new cancer center for children, he launched his own effort. He would build a hospital in the face of a hospital. Emboldened by his early fundraising success, Farber devised ever larger drives for research money, relying on his glitzy retinue of Hollywood stars, political barons, sports celebrities, and moneymakers. In 1953, when the Braves franchise left Boston for Milwaukee, Farber and Koster successfully approached the Boston Red Sox to make the Jimmy Fund their official charity. Farber soon found yet another famous recruit, Ted Williams, a young ballplayer of celluloid glamour, who had just returned after serving in the Korean War. In August 1953, the Jimmy Fund planned a Welcome Home Ted party for Williams, a massive fundraising bash with a dinner billed at $100 per plate that raised $150,000. By the end of that year, Williams was a regular visitor at Farber's clinic, often trailing a retinue of tabloid photographers seeking pictures of the great ballplayer with a young cancer patient. The Jimmy Fund became a household name and a household cause, a large white piggy bank for donations, shaped like an enormous baseball, was placed outside the Statler Hotel. Advertisements for the Children's Cancer Research Fund were plastered across billboards throughout Boston. Countless red and white collection canisters, called Jimmy's Cans, sprouted up outside movie theaters. Funds poured in from sources large and small, $100,000 from the NCI, $5,000 from a bean supper in Boston, $111 from a lemonade stand, a few dollars from a children's circus in New Hampshire. By the early summer of 1952, Farber's new building, a large, solid cube perched on the edge of Binney Street just off Longwood Avenue, was almost ready. It was lean, functional, and modern, self-consciously distinct from the marbled columns and gargoyles of the hospitals around it. One could see the obsessive hand of Farber in the details. A product of the 1930s, Farber was instinctively frugal. You can take the child out of the depression, but you can't take the depression out of the child, Leonard Lauder liked to say about his generation. But with Jimmy's clinic, Farber pulled out all the stops. The wide cement steps leading up to the front foyer, graded by only an inch, so that children could easily climb them, were steam-heated against the brutal Boston blizzards that had nearly stopped Farber's work 5 winters before. Upstairs, the clean, well-lit waiting room had whirring carousels and boxes full of toys. A toy electric train set into a stone mountain chugged on its tracks. A television set was embedded on the face of the model mountain. If a little girl got attached to a doll, Time reported in 1952, she could keep it. There were more where it came from. A library was filled with hundreds of books, 3 rocking horses, and 2 bicycles. Instead of the usual portraits of dead professors that haunted the corridors of the neighboring hospitals, Farber commissioned an artist to paint full-size pictures of fairy book characters, Snow White, Pinocchio, and Jiminy Cricket. It was Disney World fused with Cancerland. The fanfare and pomp might have led a casual viewer to assume that Farber had almost found his cure for leukemia, and the brand new clinic was his victory lap. But in truth, his goal, a cure for leukemia, still eluded him. His Boston group had now added another drug, a steroid, to their anti-leukemia regimen. And by assiduously combining steroids and antifolates, the remissions had been stretched out by several months. But despite the most aggressive therapy, the leukemia cells eventually grew resistant and recurred, often furiously. The children who played with the dolls and toy trains in the bright rooms downstairs were inevitably brought back to the glum wards in the hospital, delirious or comatose, and in terminal agony. One woman whose child was treated for cancer in Farber's clinic in the early 50s wrote, "Once I discover that almost all the children I see are doomed to die within a few months, I never cease to be astonished by the cheerful atmosphere that generally prevails. True, upon closer examination, the parents' eyes look suspiciously bright with tears shed and unshed. Some of the children's robust looks, I find, are owing to one of the anti-leukemia drugs that produces a swelling of the body. And there are children with scars, children with horrible swellings on different parts of their bodies, children missing a limb, children with shaven heads, looking pale and wan, clearly as a result of recent surgery, children limping or in wheelchairs, children coughing, and children emaciated." Indeed, the closer one looked, the more sharply the reality hit. Ensconced in his new, airy building, with dozens of assistants swirling around him, Farber must have been haunted by that inescapable fact. He was trapped in his own waiting room, still looking for yet another drug to eke out a few more months of remission in his children. His patients, having walked up the fancy steamed stairs to his office, having pranced around on the musical carousel and immersed themselves in the cartoonish gleam of happiness, would die, just as inexorably, of the same kinds of cancer that had killed them in 1947. But for Farber, the lengthening, deepening remissions bore quite another message. He needed to expand his efforts even further, to launch a concerted battle against leukemia. "Acute leukemia," he wrote in 1953, "has responded to a more marked degree than any other form of cancer, to the new chemicals that have been developed within the last few years. Prolongation of life, amelioration of symptoms, and a return to a far happier and even a normal life for weeks and many months have been produced by their use." Farber needed a means to stimulate and fund the effort to find even more powerful anti-leukemia drugs. "We are pushing ahead as fast as possible," he wrote in another letter. But it was not quite fast enough for him. The money that he had raised in Boston has dwindled to a disturbingly small amount, he noted. He needed a larger drive, a larger platform, and perhaps a larger vision for cancer. He had outgrown the house that Jimmy had built. Part 2. An Impatient War. Perhaps there is only one cardinal sin, impatience. Because of impatience, we were driven out of paradise. Because of impatience, we cannot return. Franz Kafka. The 325,000 patients with cancer who are going to die this year cannot wait. Nor is it necessary, in order to make great progress in the cure of cancer, for us to have the full solution of all the problems of basic research. The history of medicine is replete with examples of cures obtained years, decades, and even centuries before the mechanism of action was understood for these cures. Sidney Farber. Why don't we try to conquer cancer by America's 200th birthday? What a holiday that would be. Advertisement published in the New York Times by the Laskerites, December 1969. They form a society. All of this demonstrates why few research scientists are in policy-making positions of public trust. Their training for detail produces tunnel vision, and men of broader perspective are required for useful application of scientific progress. Michael Shimkin. I am aware of some alarm in the scientific community that singling out cancer for a direct presidential initiative will somehow lead to the eventual dismantling of the National Institutes of Health. I do not share these feelings. We are at war with an insidious, relentless foe. We rightly demand clear, decisive action, not endless committee meetings, interminable reviews, and tired justifications of the status quo. Lister Hill. In 1831, Alexis de Tocqueville, the French aristocrat, toured the United States and was astonished by the obsessive organizational energy of its citizens. Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all dispositions constantly form associations of a thousand other kinds, religious, moral, serious, feudal, general or restricted, enormous or diminutive, Tocqueville wrote. Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns, to construct churches, to diffuse books, to send missionaries to the Antipodes. If it is proposed to inculcate some truth or to foster some feeling by the encouragement of a great example, they form a society. More than a century after Tocqueville toured the States, as Farber sought to transform the landscape of cancer, he instinctively grasped the truth behind Tocqueville's observation. If visionary changes were best forged by groups of private citizens forming societies, then Farber needed such a coalition to launch a national attack on cancer. This was a journey that he could not begin or finish alone. He needed a colossal force behind him, a force that would far exceed the Jimmy Fund in influence, organization, and money. Real money and the real power to transform still lay under congressional control. But prying open vast federal coffers meant deploying the enormous force of a society of private citizens, and Farber knew that this scale of lobbying was beyond him. There was, he knew, one person who possessed the energy, resources, and passions for this project, a pugnacious New Yorker who had declared it her personal mission to transform the geography of American health through group building, lobbying, and political action. Wealthy, politically savvy, and well-connected, she lunched with the Rockefellers, danced with the Trumans, dined with the Kennedys, and called Lady Bird Johnson by her first name. Farber had heard of her from his friends and donors in Boston. He had run into her during his early political forays in Washington. Her disarming smile and frozen bouffant were as recognizable in the political circles in Washington as in the salons of New York. Just as recognizable was her name, Mary Woodard Lasker. Mary Woodard was born in Watertown, Wisconsin, in 1900. Her father, Frank Woodard, was a successful small-town banker. Her mother, Sarah Johnson, had emigrated from Ireland in the 1880s, worked as a saleswoman at the Carson's department store in Chicago, and ascended briskly through professional ranks to become one of the highest-paid saleswomen at the store. Salesmanship, as Lasker would later write, was a natural talent for Johnson. Johnson had later turned from her work at the department store